And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Reed Farrell Coleman back to the program today. Reed is probably best known for his long-running Moe Prager Detective series, which he ended in 2014 after 9 installments. He has also carried on Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone series, with his fourth contribution coming out in September of 2017. But today we'll be talking about his new series, featuring retired Long Island beat cop Gus Murphy. The first book in the series, Where It Hurts, was published in 2016 and is a finalist for the 2017 Edgar Award for Best Novel. The second title has just been published by G.P. Putnam Sons, and it's called What You Break. Reed, how much time has passed between the end of Where It Hurts and the new Gus Murphy book, What You Break?
About a year. In Where It Hurts, it was 2 years after the death of Gus's son. Now we've progressed, you know, several months at least. Beyond that, I don't think I'm trying to be too specific time-wise, because that gets you in a lot of trouble.
You're not going to have him age in real time like Moe Prager did?
Well, he might age in soap opera time. In other words, as convenient for my plot as I need it to be.
Because it's the springtime for this book, and it's just right before Christmas and the last one, right?
Right. So several months. It's a funny thing to bring up Jesse Stone now, but the fact is that Ace Atkins and I always talk about Parker time, because when you start a series, it's not something you think about, but you wind up having to deal with it. And with Parker, our books with Parker, you know, you realize Spencer is, you know, fought in Korea and fought Jersey Joe Walcott. Jesse has been like 40 years old for 20 years. So I'm going to keep Gus at, in his early 40s maybe for a while.
So the last one's around Christmas time. This one's around Easter. Is there going to be some kind of like a holiday anchor for the stories?
Yeah, Yom Kippur.
Well, atonement is a big theme in the books.
It is. I think one of the things that attracts me to the P.I., novel and hard-boiled fiction is the trope of redemption, atonement, setting the world right. It is, for me, one of the things I loved about the books I read, The Hammett and Chandler, MacDonald, is the thought that a crime is committed, the world is put out of balance. And though you really may not be able to restore balance in the larger sense, in some small sense, the PI is fighting for justice. The PI is Don Quixote or the sheriff in High Noon. Some sense of right, justice, and balance is restored at the end of a PI novel.
I heard someone say about the mystery novel that it wasn't necessarily justice that was served. It was returning the community to order.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, we all have our own formulations of it, but I think that is one of the real hooks for the writer, is that sense of, let me throw the world out of order and let me see if I can restore some order. Like right now, I'm reading Michael Connelly's The Wrong Side of Goodbye. I respect Michael's writing immensely. And you can tell this is where Bosch is a restorer of balance, of some sense of right and justice. And that's what he lives for. And that, you know, he might as well be Don Quixote. And Michael does him so well.
Now, Gus is a retired Long Island cop, and he wasn't a police detective. He was more along a beat cop. And he was a good cop, not because he has this really huge moral sense, I don't think, but he just thought life would be easier if he followed the rules and wasn't dirty.
Well, the funny thing is Gus is a guy who thinks he understands the world, because as many people who have what they want, rich or poor, middle class or not, when you get what you want, you think you understand how the game is played, how it works.
And you have it, so therefore you earned it and you did the right things.
Right. And Gus is a guy, I think, who we would all agree, if you've read the books or intend to read the books, you'll find out he did deserve it. He was the good neighbor. As I describe, like I said to you before we went on, that it snowed when I was away and that my wife had to shovel. Well, Gus was the type of guy, if he was your neighbor, he would have gone over and seen that I wasn't home, and he would have shoveled the driveway. Not because he felt he would get some reward for it, but that's how you should be. So Gus is that kind of guy. He has the things he wants because he doesn't want that much. He has a lovely wife, two beautiful kids, a great pension, by the way. If you're a Suffolk County cop, you get a very good pension. So he a house, you know, in a great town. So he figures, I've got it made. And then it all blows up on him.
And he's having to make a lot more moral decisions now in his current life.
Right. Well, you know, when you're a cop, you do your job. Because there are set rules when you're a cop. And Gus is a rule follower. He knows, or he used to be a rule follower. And one of the joys of this series is, unlike the other series I've written, even unlike Jesse Stone, Gus used to be somebody else before his son died. And now he's evolving. So Gus isn't set in stone the way Jesse is, let's say, or Mo was. Mo was always a cynical, you know, New Yorker. And when he was on the job, when he was off the job, no matter what, he was who he was. Whereas even Gus says it in the beginning of What You Break. That's how life is. John Jr. was alive, then he was dead. Now it's another world. He's somebody else. So he's an evolving character, which is kind of fun to write, an evolving character, because I don't even know who he'll be.
Well, and he's not even technically a PI.
No. No, I have to confess that I was very heavily influenced by Lawrence Block's Matt Scudder, who did favors, who was an ex-cop, who he's never got his license either. He just did favors for people. And I always found that kind of intriguing because, you know, when you hang out the shingle, it's different than being roped into cases. And that's what I enjoy, the conceit of having an unofficial PI being roped into cases.
Now, he has a day job with the Paragon Hotel, which he points out is a second-class hotel, not a third-rate hotel. But he wears a lot of hats there. What all is he responsible for?
Yeah,
there?
Because he doesn't live with his family anymore, he lives at the Paragon Hotel. So in order to get that room, he drives the courtesy van, and he's the ersatz house detective. And on Friday and Saturday nights, they have a club called the Full Flaps Lounge, and he works the door. So he's like a bouncer, the house detective, and the courtesy van driver.
So when does he have time to do his independent investigations?
Well, he usually drives at night. So during the day, his days are free, and he can conveniently take time off when the author needs him to.
Because he does have a lot more latitude than he would have when he was on the police force.
That's correct. You can't just take off shifts. You know, oh, I think I'll take off today. No, but his life lends itself to the setup I've given it, lends itself to that kind of work.
Now, you mentioned his family busted apart after his son died unexpectedly. He and his ex-wife, Annie, have a very odd relationship going on after their divorce.
Yes, because they're tied together by, you know, when you have children with somebody, you are tied to that person regardless. And when one of your children dies, you are bound together forever. There's no escaping that because the tragedy of that, the loss, binds you together in a very odd way. And people, what I found is grief is different for everybody. It's as individual as anything is. And for some people, their grief, anger is a huge part of their grief, and it's how they deal with loss. Other people withdraw. So I would say that Gus and Annie have a yo-yoing type of relationship. They can't escape each other. And sometimes they come together and make love, but it's not really love. It's just an expression of their anger and grief. And a way for Gus sees it, I think, sometimes as a way to remember, to keep his son's memory alive. And I think Annie just sees it as, you know, a way to let go of some of her rage.
And their daughter has had a hard time dealing with all of the death and then the breakup of the family, too.
Of course, because, you know, John Jr. was her older brother and best friend. And, of course, Annie and Gus have each other to take it out on, but she's kind of lost. And in the first book, in Where It Hurts, she's right at the end of a cycle of kind of a self-destructive cycle. And in the second book and later in the first book, she's coming to the realization that that's got to stop, that her brother is dead, but she isn't.
Now, Gus is starting to find a bit of equilibrium in his life, and a man greatly responsible for that is the former priest, Father Bill.
That's right. What's funny about Father Bill is I get asked a lot about Father Bill. Like, where did you come up with Father Bill? I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't often do second drafts of books. Usually I edit books, but I'm a fierce self-editor as I write. So I don't usually get it all out, then go back and edit. But Where It Hurts is a book I did two drafts on, and largely because Father Bill didn't appear until page 200 in the first draft. And he said to me, I am way too important a character to come in two-thirds of the book. You need to go back and put me in the book. Really, I largely rewrote Where It Hurts based on Father Bill coming so late in the book and saying, no, he's too good a character. He's too important to the series to have him appear so late. So I literally went back and rewrote the book with him playing a much more important role in the book.
Now, when you start off a new series, I mean, how much architecture are you putting together at the beginning? And then how much has Gus changed from your original conception to where he is now?
You know, it's a funny thing. I'm not an outliner. So I don't go into things with the whole story in my head or big, long story arcs. I usually pay as I go. I create it as I go because I work under the theory that if it surprises me and excites me, it'll surprise and excite the reader. So I kind of knew who Gus was. I knew the situation he was in, but I hadn't populated his world. I don't usually populate the world of my series until I need a character to fulfill a role, and then I create the character. So that's what's exciting to me about first books in a series, is I discover the characters. I don't think readers can quite appreciate how exciting that is for me, to discover who's in this world. I don't pre-plan it. I mean, I knew there would be Gus, and I knew there would be Annie, and that was about it. And I create the characters as the plot develops.
Now, let's talk about two characters that are very different from each other. And the first is Smudge, who you can kind of see why the world has treated him so badly.
People talk a lot about the other characters in the book and don't talk a lot about Smudge. But to me, Smudge is about my favorite character other than Gus. Smudge is, you know, that guy who's destined to be a loser in the world. He's
born to be hit.
What? He's born to be hit. He's born to be the kid that picked on, born to be the kid who doesn't get picked when you're choosing sides. He is scrawny. He has a hair lip. He has a huge birthmark, a muddy birthmark on his cheek, which is why he's called Smudge. Because of his hair lip, and that there's been very bad surgery done on it, he has a lisp. So he says Smudge, you know, with Smudge. It's so he's got it coming and going. And as he says, he did time in jail. Gus asks him why, and he said, well, it was a con, because people always feel sorry for me. They would always give money because I was good at making people feel sorry for me. Yet he is the character with the most faith of anybody in the book. He goes to mass every day. And so I find him an interesting, paradoxical character.
And then someone who is enigmatic as possible is Slava, who's the doorman at the Paragon Hotel, and he is a cipher.
Yeah, he's an interesting character. To me, fans, I have to tell you, he's fans' favorite character. When the first book came out and I toured it, people kept saying, we need to know more about Slava.
Well, he's so unknown, you can project so much onto him.
Right, and they love the way he speaks because he refers to himself in the third person and he's got a very thick Slavic accent, you know. Slava, you have to listen to Slava, for he is talking like this. And people can hear that in their head, even though obviously there's no sound when they're reading, they can hear that in their head. He is a big peasanty looking guy
Strong like bull.
Strong like bull, dumb like ox, you know, like that. He seems to have more talents than he should have in the dark arts. And so he is an intriguing character for readers. He's an intriguing character for me.
It's at the beginning of What You Break that Gus picks up a guy at the airport, MacArthur Airport, which is in the middle of Long Island, to take him to the Paragon Hotel. And he's a really suspicious-looking character. And he just happens to see this man and Slava exchange a look.
Right. You know, in the first book, I allude to Slava's dark past. In fact, that's one of the things Gus comments on, is that people work the night shift at the Paragon because they all have stories not to tell. And the darkness helps hide their pasts. Slava clearly has some dark past, which he refers to, but forbids Gus from ever asking him about. And so, of course, like the readers, Gus is curious about Slava's past, and he's promised never to ask him. So when he sees Slava, who Gus thinks doesn't have a friend in the world, and this guy he's just picked up at the airport, exchange kind of a knowing glance, and they clearly know each other, Gus is roped in. He's got to find out what the connection is between those two men.
How's he gotten so curious in his life, Gus?
I think the great question for Gus, and it goes back to the death of his son. Why? Because he was not the kind of guy before his son's death to question anything. He was a rule follower. Things happened, they happened for a reason. And then his son died for apparently no reason, and there was no one for him to see about it. So answering the question why has become kind of the central theme of Gus's life. So if you come to him with a why, or he has a curiosity about something and he wants to know why, he can't help himself now. That's what I mean about the evolving of a character. He was never like that, but now he can't help himself.
So obviously we're going to find something out about Slava in this book, which leaves Felix, the desk clerk, who's originally from the Philippines, as the guy we really don't know anything about now.
Well, not yet.
Let's go back to Father Bill.
Sure.
And beyond helping him deal with the grief of losing his son, Father Bill also played a key role in the first book. And Gus owes him. And he brings a man named Micah Spears into Gus's life. And he is not a pleasant man.
No, he's not a pleasant man. He's based on me. No, Micah Spears is a very unpleasant man. He's kind of like a very well put together, well-tailored toad. You know, the guy's clearly not a warm human being. He's got a lot of money, and he's also a bully. And I think we have a natural repellence to bullies. And Gus has that fiercely. But Micah Spears has two magical things that will always get Gus's attention. One is he offers, and this isn't giving too much away, he offers Gus money to establish a foundation in his late son's name. So, of course, Gus is attracted to that idea. And two, he has a why question for Gus, the big why question, because Micah Spears' granddaughter has been brutally murdered, absolutely brutally murdered. Normally in a PI novel, right? Gus, you have to find the murderer, the cops can't do it. But in this case, that's not the case. They have the murderer. They know who he is. He's in jail in Riverhead awaiting trial. But the question is, the guy who did it won't tell anybody why he did it. And so what's the thing I said before about Gus is why. So Gus is like, you know, honey to a bee. He's so drawn to why questions. So he's as curious as, I think, even more than the money being offered is the chance to find out why is so attractive to him that he takes the case.
He is really seeking for his place and his understanding of the universe, it seems.
It is. And that's so different than who he used to be.
So his granddaughter, Lynn Trang, is yet another person, as we learned during the course of the story. She goes by LT. She's been adopted from Vietnam by his son. And she's one of so many people that are hiding things. There are so many secrets. There are so many misrepresentations of who people are throughout the course of the books.
Well, I think one of the themes of all of my books, except the Jesse Stone novels, which, you know, they're not my books, is it's hard enough to know who you are, so it's almost impossible to know other people. I think we're all hiding. I mean, it's my belief that we hide from ourselves. We hide our darkest parts of ourselves. We always want to present the best image of ourselves, project the best image of ourselves outwards. I was on TV earlier, right? I didn't go in a ripped T-shirt and my sneakers, and I went in a suit jacket and a freshly pressed white shirt to look my best. Even though I had a rough night last night and a long day, I think we all, and to some extent, large and small, hide who we are from the world. So Lynn Trang, she can't really hide who she is because she's Asian. You know, even though the Asian population is increasing, she still sticks out. She can never hide who she is, at least externally, but she can hide who she is inside.
What's the last difficult thing you've come to terms with yourself about?
I went to therapy for 8 years to sort of get rid of my demons. I grew up in a very angry family. In fact, that I always attribute that to how I started writing. We were screamers. We communicated everything through yelling and anger. And I'm not exaggerating. But, you know, when you live in a house where everybody screams at each other, no one hears anything. And so I always say I started writing so I could be heard. So there was a way for me to be heard above the noise or below the noise. My parents grew up pretty poor, so they were very resentful people, and they kind of passed that on. And so I'm no longer jealous or resentful, and hopefully I'm not as angry as I used to be. So, yeah, I mean, we all have demons. Some of us don't deal with them. I've tried to deal with mine.
Gus isn't from Coney Island, but you are, and the story does move into Coney Island for a bit.
Yeah, I wanted to give a nod to the Mo series. So, and don't forget, I may be very familiar with that area, but Gus isn't me. And that's another distinction. In fact, one of the reasons I did have this happen in Coney Island was that Gus is telling the reader, I'm not familiar with Coney Island. He's not Mo. He's not me. Whereas Mo is a lot like me. We went to the same high school. We have the same background, whatever. Whereas Gus and I are very different. So to my loyal readers, it's a signal that Gus is not me. And I like putting characters in places they're not familiar with because it's on unsteady ground. And Gus gets in the middle of something when you're in an unfamiliar place. You can't be so sure of how you act. And that's why I put him in Coney Island.
And also, you've talked about your growth and your changing over the years. And Coney Island and Brighton Beach area have changed so many over the years. We have a large Russian gangster population
there. Yes, they do. Can I tell you a funny story?
Oh, I'd love to hear a funny story.
So my friend Eddie, who's one of the guys I grew up with, he still lives in the old neighborhood. So he's lived through the transition, whereas I moved out of Brooklyn like 34 years ago. Eddie still lives there. And so he had some friends come to visit, and he took them to a Russian nightclub restaurant type place. There are a few of these in the area. And as the check comes, and Eddie looks at the bill, and he's going to treat, and there's a $20 charge. That doesn't seem to be the tip. It doesn't seem to be the tax. And he says to the waiter, he calls the waiter over, and he says, excuse me, what's this for? And the waiter points to a big guy sitting in a chair by the door, like cleaning his nails. And the waiter says, he's for the guy. And Eddie says, what do you mean it's for the guy? And the waiter says, pay, he's for the guy. And Eddie says, I'm not paying this. And the waiter says, for your own good, he's for the guy. And he did. So I've always wanted to write a short story about the guy. You know, what he really does. I mean, he was basically being extorted.
Well, it's pay. The cover charge.
Yeah, the cover charge to get out.
Yeah.
So I always love that story.
Now, you mentioned Ace Atkins earlier. You both continue on Robert B. Parker series, but he said there's so much Chandler in your writing. When you get a compliment like that, how does that make you feel?
First of all, to get a compliment from Ace is quite a compliment because Ace is a fantastic writer. and a really good guy. But it always feels great to get a compliment from your peers, right? Because they know. As I once wrote to Lee Child after I read one of his books, and I said, what a great book, Lee. And he said, I always love compliments from a man who's seen the man behind the curtain. So to be compared to Raymond Chandler, as I have been, to me, that's the greatest compliment. That from one writer to another or in a review to compare me to Hammett or Chandler. I don't think there's anything I could, as a writer, even winning the Edgar, wouldn't be as good as someone comparing me to Raymond Chandler, because that's why I do what I do.
Now, outside of other writers, the New York Times called you now the King of Long Island, and will your rule be a benevolent one?
Well, you can kiss the ring when we're done with the interview.
Now, the last time you were here, and we talked about the Jesse Stone book you had written for the Parker State, you're still doing that, and we also talked about your background in poetry. And now with the new Jesse Stone book coming out, The Hangman's Sonnet, you've brought poetry into Robert B. Parker's world.
I did, and as a matter of fact, I had to write a sonnet for the book. So let me tell you a little bit about the book. I think the setup is, to me, I would buy this book based upon the setup. The plot is basically this. A Bob Dylan-like character, it's 1975, and he records this album that allegedly the greatest rock players in the world are playing on this album with him. Clapton's playing guitar, Entwistle's playing bass, Ringo's playing drums, and the album is called The Hangman's Sonnet, and it's based upon a sonnet this Dylan-like figure found in a Buffalo soldier's diary. And it's about a guy, he writes it before he's going to be hanged. You know, this Dylan-like figure has written this song cycle. He has the best players in the world coming to play, and the master tape disappears. And now it's 50 years later, and the tape has never resurfaced. And this Bob Dylan-like character is going to have a big birthday bash on Stiles Island near Paradise. And rumors circulate that, guess what's resurfacing? That tape might resurface. This PI named Spencer, who might just make an appearance in this book. So,
are there 14 songs on the album to be one for each of the sonnets?
Each line, no. you know, that's part of the mystery of it. It was a really interesting, like, I was so excited to write this book because that's one of those ideas, like, wow. There are books I'm excited, more excited than others to write, and I was really excited to write this book.
For me, at least, when I've read authors who write lyrics, they seldom ring true. How's it writing poetry for another person's mind?
Well, you know, since the poem is some dead guy who's been hung, it was easy for me to put myself in his place. And that's the fun part of writing, isn't it, for writing fiction, is you get to live a lot of different lives. I mean, that's what it is for me, because all of my characters are alive for me. I mean, when I see bad writing, it is when minor characters seem like minor characters, like they have no internal life. For me, every character I write has an internal life, even that hanged guy who wrote that poem was real to me. So it was easy for me to actually write that sonnet.
And so when can we expect that book out?
September 2017.
And are you working on another Gus book right now?
I am, in fact, working on the 2018 Jesse Stone novel right now. And we're negotiating for more Gus books now. So we'll see.
Well, Reed, I want to thank you so much for stopping back by. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, great being here. Thank you for having me.
Reed Farrell Coleman is the author of What You Break, the second installment of the Gus Murphy series. It's published by G.P. Putnam Sons. I'm Stephen Usfury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.